Paul is under house arrest in Rome, and man, poor Paul. This poor sap. I mean, he's been at this whole thing of Christian service for 3 decades at this point, and now he's under arrest right at the zenith, the peak of his career. He's old. He's, you know, stuck. You know, I mean, on the one hand, he's brilliant, so it's like in one sense, we could be envious of him. He's educated, he's restless, he's relentless, he's charismatic. As we argued before, doubtless the best Christian worker in the Christian movement at this time, and yet he's sitting there languishing in prison. I can't imagine the torment you would be feeling here. I mean, he's trapped in what's referred to as house arrest. House arrest is when you're stuck in a house and you had a patron that instead of allowing you to go into like real arrest, like real Roman prison, they paid to get like a rent-a-cop to be there with you around the clock, these, you know, different shifts so that you could be in a house and so people could have access to you. So he's in house arrest. But the houses are not MTV cribs. You know what I mean? Like they're tiny little one-room houses. And in this house, you're chained to a Praetorian guardsman. So this is like SEAL Team 6. These are some of the hardest core soldiers in the Roman Empire. And now they're starting to retire and they're taking on these odd jobs like guarding prisoners here, like in houses and stuff like that. So you're chained to one of these guys and it's a short chain. So too, you're under 24/7 observation. 24/7. That's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And Paul has been in house arrest for something like 3 to 4 years at this point. As I said, they had 4-hour shifts. So Paul would be seeing a new, disgruntled, hardened, you know, weathered soldier every 4 hours. Moreover, he is there awaiting capital punishment. He's waiting to die. When he goes to face Nero Caesar, is he going to get the guilty verdict? If so, they're going to chop his head off as a Roman citizen. Well, this has all of the makings of psychological destruction. To be stuck in a room with someone you don't like, you don't love, you don't want to be around, someone who's gruff, pretty mean, and they change shifts every couple hours. I mean, you don't have any privacy. I mean, just to be able to take a shower, maybe sit on the toilet for a little bit, and then you go to wipe, and you're like, man, that chain is not that long. You know what I mean? And you're lonely. Poor Paul, man. Poor Paul. Or is it poor Paul? In this letter, Paul is giving us a little window into what he's thinking and feeling at this very moment. He says in verse 12, "Now I want you to know, dear brothers and sisters, that my circumstances have turned out terribly. Didn't you hear what I just said? Everything is running off the rails. The wheels are coming off the bus. Life is awful." That's what you would say. I mean, if you were writing a letter and you only had a little bit of room and you wanted to write something, "My circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." According to Paul, as he's sitting there, the first thing he's thinking about writing is he's like, yeah, my circumstances. What should I say about my circumstances? Well, they're turning out for the greater progress of Jesus' message of love and forgiveness. And so, if there's anything that we could take from this passage, it's this. So if there's anything you can walk away with, it's this. Our circumstances in life are far, far less important than our view of our circumstances. Let me repeat that. Our circumstances in life are far less important than our view of those circumstances. Why is this the case? Because when you think about the big questions of life, if these are solid, if these are stable, then we can view the world as a worldview through this grid, which is a worldview. Now, the idea of a worldview is that it's supposed to line up with the world. It's not supposed to be like an imagination land that you invent. It's supposed to reflect reality. However, if you have a worldview that does reflect upon reality and it answers the big questions of life, what this means is that the small circumstances in which we live can be handled on the burden, on the foundation of that worldview. What kind of questions? Well, for one, Do we need a purpose to life? Do we need a purpose to life, a purpose for which to live? You know, imagine if you were at a coffee shop and a stranger walks up to you and in a very covert, kind of sneaky, kind of creepy, kind of interesting sort of a way walks up to you and, well, he hands you a map and it looks like this. And you're like, I know what that is. That's Columbus. That's where I live. And he marks this out here, you know, the corner of Nationwide Boulevard and High Street. He even puts those cool circles to let you know, northwest side of the street. And then on the note, it says, meet me here tomorrow at 7 a.m. And then he leaves. Would you go? Some of you are like, stranger danger. No way would I go. Why would I do that? Meet me here. I mean, it's not like it's not clear, right? Like, it's clear. Meet me here tomorrow at 7 a.m. I know what tomorrow means. I know what the time is. I know where here is. Here's here. Would you go? No, you wouldn't go. You wouldn't wake up early. Like, you wouldn't take your time and energy to meet a random stranger at a random place at a random time. You wouldn't do that, right? You wouldn't. And how long would that take? I mean, that could be during rush hour. This could take an hour to get downtown, depending on traffic, and then to come back. You wouldn't do that. Why wouldn't you do that? Well, because there's no, what's the word? Purpose. There's no purpose to go there. Now here is where the truth is stranger than fiction. Because many people wake up every single day of their lives and they don't know the reason for which they exist. So instead of making one trip at 7 a.m. on one morning from one random person, they make countless trips every day, every week, every month, every year, and they don't have a single explanation as to why. I've talked to some people. I said, so what's the purpose to your life? You know, what turns your crank? What gets you going in the morning? You know, what is it? And they're like, well, I don't know. You don't know. You don't know. You wouldn't go to the corner of High Street and Nationwide Boulevard once because there was no purpose. And yet you're willing to live an entire life. You have one life to live and then that's it. It's over. This is a very precious commodity. And you don't have this figured out. I remember talking to a young agnostic student years ago. We were on a beach trip together and he asked me a question. You know, he said, well, you know, couldn't it just be that I make up my own purpose to life, something to that effect? And I had one of those moments. It must have been God where he like shut my stupid mouth like for a second to think, you know, and then I was just like, I don't know. What do you think? You think like a subjective purpose is good enough? And he said, No, it's not good enough. Like anyone just makes up their own purpose. What's the difference between that and no purpose? I was like, I couldn't have said it better myself. You're right. Do we need to have value in life? Value in life. Well, according to these psychological data here, there's a strong case that your values can actually impact the quality of your life. Those who reported, quote, highly meaningful lives reported a 30% reduction in mortality, in death. So too, according to Kelly McGonigal, she writes in her book, The Upside of Stress, she says, writing about your values is one of the most effective psychological interventions ever studied. She says, even writing about your values, what you think is important, not how you feel or what would make you feel good, but what you value, what you think is important, whether or not you feel good. She says writing about that for 10 minutes one time can have an effect months and even years later. Because later when you're in the thick of it, when you're in the suffering and the pain and the perseverance, you're thinking to yourself, okay, I know this doesn't feel good, but I have values. I have something for which I'm living. I have a cause for which I'm living. And it's based on that cause I'm willing to put up with quite a bit. Think about this for a second. This woman made it into the Guinness Book of World Records because she has the biggest collection of Winnie the Pooh dolls. 10,002 dolls. That's what she values. And you might be like, well, what's your problem? Like, why are you against Winnie the Pooh or something? Like, what's the big deal? Okay, like, whatever floats your boat. Like, if you want to have a collection and you know, maybe you're an old lady and kind of scary looking and, like, you want to have a Winnie the Pooh collection? Like, that's cool. Like, that's cool for you, all right? But when it comes to, like, value, like, what is it that I'm going to value in my life? Collecting a bunch of poo together. No, that is not a stable enough value system there. No way, not even close. Winnie the Pooh dolls. Do we need significance? Yes, we do. Significance, that sense that what I'm doing really matters. That it doesn't just, you know, blow up in smoke and cinder at the end of my life. That I'm moving toward a goal, that my ambitions mean something. Is this heading anywhere? Am I significant? Why do I matter? If I went to the ocean and I pulled a speck of sand off of the ground and, you know, somehow got rid of it, would that ocean and that sand barge be any different? Of course not. Obviously not. Nobody would even be able to tell. Well, I'm just one of 7.3 billion other pieces of sand, chemicals and juices, you know, walking around on this planet. If somebody came and plucked me out of this whole mass of humanity, would that even matter? Am I significant? Stephen King, whom I believe to be the master of horror in many different facets, in his book Misery, has the case of Paul Sheldon, who is, of course, in every Stephen King book, a master fiction writer like Stephen King. And he goes off the road and he gets into an accident and he gets captured by this diabolical nurse. I think her name is Annie Wilkes. And in the book, she's like the number one fan of Paul Sheldon. She just loves this author. But she reads his most recent manuscript, the manuscript that is like his magnum opus. Like, he's been writing all this romantic, you know, book crap for like years and he's sick of that. But now he's actually written a piece of like real, like Americana, like good. This is like Ernest Hemingway good. Like, he's gonna bust out of the romantic literature and he's gonna become like a real author. And this is his life's work. But this is the only manuscript. There's no Dropbox. This is the 90s, okay? There's no like hard drives. There's nothing to back this up. This is the only manuscript. And this diabolical woman, who's played by Kathy Bates in the movie, has him pinned down and doesn't like the story, and she tells him, burn it. And this is the clip from the video. I'll share it with you.
I'll tell you what. Doesn't ever have to be published. No one ever has to read it. I'll just keep it for myself. No one will even know it exists.
As long as it does exist, your mind won't ever be free. I think you should light the match, Paul. You're doing the right thing.
Oh, my goodness! Goodness gracious! Oh, my! Oh, goodness! Heaven's the best! Oh, goodness! Oh, my goodness! Oh, oh, heaven's the best! Oh, goodness! Oh.
It's a pretty moving scene. You should read the book to get into the psychology of what it's like to be looking at your life's work right there. And the whole thing goes up in ashes. I don't know if you could put yourself in his shoes, that nauseating feeling. It's all right there. And I'm being watched or asked to watch it burn. Well, imagine that you don't just go through life and a book that you wrote is burned up. Okay, that'd be pretty bad. What if you go through life and you see that your entire life burned up? Like, you get to the end of your life and there's nothing there. None of it mattered. A couple generations from now, nobody even knows who I was. Nobody could recognize me. Nobody, my great-grandkids likely won't even know my first name. Do you realize that? So a few generations away, the people that should have the most interest in me won't even know me. I will be wiped off the face of the earth. Do we need significance? Oh, yeah, we need significance. We definitely do. What about the afterlife? I've heard some people say, you know, I'm not afraid to die. Give me a break. You're not afraid to die. That's because you haven't thought about it. When you think about your life, okay, most people would say, what is the thing that gives meaning in your life? It's love. It's love. When you're running out of your house and it's on fire, you grab your loved one. You don't grab your goldfish. Am I right? You don't grab your, oh, I should get my guitar. You grab the people that you love. It's your love relationships that make life meaningful. Here's the kicker. In death, all of those relationships are severed forever. So if you live long enough, you'll bury your friends and loved ones. If they live long enough, they'll bury you. Every single love relationship that you have in your life is going to be ripped from you at death. And this isn't some kind of a probability. This is a certainty. This will happen. And you're saying you're not afraid of this? You're not afraid of having the thing that gives your life meaning? Like the most important thing in life? This is going to be ripped in every direction of your life. In every direction, this is going to be torn apart. You're not afraid of that? You're not afraid of that because you're not thinking about that. That's why you're not afraid of that. The specter of death is terrifying. It is horrific. That's why the Bible says that the last enemy to be defeated is death. Jesus Christ came to save all those who their entire lives were held captive by the fear of death, Hebrews 2:15. And so when we look at this, having a worldview, having a picture of the world that lines up with reality, oh, is this important? God, is this important? This would mean that the circumstances in the world would mean less, far less, than our view of them. Don't believe me? Okay, maybe you're here and you're not a believer in the Bible, but just read this as you would a first century document from a guy in prison. Okay, just do that. Check this out. Number one, Paul's view of his enemies. He says in verse 13, the very next verse, we're going to go right through. He says, my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. Paul's like, my circumstances, they're going pretty well for this message of love and forgiveness that Jesus shares. Like, for one, my enemies are hearing it, right? Now, that's an incredible reversal. Think about that for just a second. The same guys that are there on four-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, to block Paul from speaking are the same ones who are forced to listen to Paul. Yeah, you don't think God has a sense of humor here. In Philippians 4:22, Paul just kind of pokes the Romans right in the eyeball, man. I mean, they must have been like, ah, the end of the letter. He says, all the saints greet you. That's all of us, anyone who knows Jesus Christ. All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. It's just like, wait a minute, Caesar? Yeah, I'm sitting here. It's not that I'm chained to these Roman guards. Oh, no. It's that every 4 hours they come in and they're chained to me. And what on earth did they think about Paul? They must have been like, I mean, these are like big, buff, you know, SEAL Team 6 kind of guys. And they're looking at this little shrimpy Paul, this little guy. I mean, it says that he was bald. His knees would buckle together. He was kind of like, you know, chunky. And I mean, he was beaten up all the time. He's a little shrimp. These guys must have been leaving on 4 hour shifts like, okay, you're never going to believe this next guy that you're going to be chained to. I mean, he's a shrimp. He's wimpy. And yet he's tough as nails. He's like the only guy who's like half my size who will look me right in the eye and tell me that I'm full of it with my worldview. You know, I'm a polytheist. Oh my gods, you got to believe this guy. I mean, when you see him, it's going to be incredible. And so Paul, it's not poor, poor Paul. If anything, it's poor, poor Praetorian Guard that they're stuck to Paul. Number two, Paul's view of his friends. Now he's in prison. Here would be the time to whine and complain. We read in verse 14, most of the brothers and sisters trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. So Paul's looking at his situation and he's thinking to himself, okay, I'm separated from my friends, but because I'm in here, my friends are more courageous than ever. Again, another incredible reverse. Who could see that? Except someone who was sitting there meditating on the good that they're seeing in their circumstances. Think about that. Imagine a person thinking about Paul. You know, if Paul can talk about God to a hardened, weathered Roman soldier, then why can't I talk to my neighbors and my loved ones and my friends about God? If Paul could do that in prison, Surely I could talk to my friends about Christ. Number three, Paul's view of his competitors. We read in verse 15, some to be sure are preaching Christ even from envy and strife. I know that seems like a typo. Like, how could you turn this great, incredible message of love into a way to compete with other people? Isn't that crazy? Isn't it crazy? Like, we're so selfish and deranged and narcissistic that, like, we can actually turn the message of, like, love and forgiveness into something over which we compete. Yeah, we're that sinful, apparently. And Paul says there's some out there that do this. He says, they're, to be sure, like, he knows this is happening while he's in prison. He says, but some, they're telling people about Christ from goodwill. Verse 16, the latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. Now, if you were in Paul's shoes, how would you be feeling? All right, I already got the Praetorian Guard. I'm already separated from my friends. But are you kidding me here? I mean, I'm in jail. And now's the time that people are going to start to get into some kind of a pissing match with me over who's better at serving Christ. Are you kidding me? How low do you have to be? I mean, I'm in jail and now's the time that you're going to compete with me. Or, you know, thinking to yourself, you know, are you even a true Christian if you want to hurt me while I'm in these conditions? It wouldn't be hard. I know people have given up Christ for less than this. It wouldn't be hard to say I'm giving up on organized religion altogether. These are the kind of people in Christian community, well, they can have them. Any of us been in jail and that's the time when people are really trying to stick it to us? Well, what do we read? Verse 18, but what does it matter? Excuse me, did you read what you just wrote? What does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice. Do you see what he's doing there? It's like he's saying, did I stutter? Right? I'm going to rejoice over this. Yes, and I'm going to continue to rejoice over this. Again, another incredible reversal. I feel like a wrestling coach or something. Like, that's an incredible reversal there. It's like Paul is thinking to himself, you know, if I could just take myself out of this situation and look at the situation, what would I see? I'd see that Jesus' message of love and forgiveness is touching many more lives. Man, if I could just get my own ego out of this and get God's point of view, I would see that many people are coming to meet Christ, and I'm going to rejoice over that. Let me repeat. Yes, I will continue to rejoice over that. Finally, number four, Paul's view of death itself. Well, all that Pollyanna stuff, come on. You know, your friends, your competitors, your enemies, but death? Yes, death. Paul says in verse 19, he says, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. The word there is soteria. This is the word from which we get salvation. You're saved. You're rescued. What does it mean in this context? Some people think that it means that you're saved in the sense that Paul's saying, I'm going to go to heaven. Other people think he's going to be saved in the sense from death. Others say it's that he's going to be saved from prison. Well, I'm not going to give you all the convoluted explanations. I'll just give you my view, which I believe to be the right view. But you can judge for yourself. Your prayers and provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, it can't be that he's saying, because you're praying for me, that's how I know I'm going to heaven. That would be like nails on a chalkboard to Paul. Paul's later going to say, it's not because of my righteousness, it's because of Christ. Philippians 3:9, we'll get there later. It's not that he's sure he's going to get away from death. Oh no, because later he says, whether in life or in death. It can't be that he's going to get out of prison because he's not sure what's going to happen. Here's my view. My view is, I'm going to get out of jail one way or another. Either I'm going to face Caesar and I'm going to be vindicated, or I'm going to face Caesar and I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be murdered. And then I'm going to be with Christ seconds later. Either way, I'm not going to be here for much longer. Yeah, my deliverance. He says, I know. Oida is the word, like deep in his gut. I know this is going to happen. There's going to be deliverance here. He says, according to my earnest expectation and hope that I will not be put to shame in anything. He's got this confidence here, earnest expectation. To be sure, this is a difficult word. I mean, just look at that sucker. Apo kara dokia. All right. Apo means away. Kara means your head. And dekomai means to take. So away head to take. How do you translate that? It's kind of like away your head. You're taking it. It's like stretching the head forward. It's like the wide receiver reaching out, you know, with everything that he has. It's like the Olympic athlete as she's crossing the finish line. And it's like everything she can to put her, you know, chin forward, her chest forward, reaching out for everything that she has. That's what this is. His earnest expectation. It's almost like, how should we put it? Singular focus, zeroing in according to my singular focus and hope. I'm giving this everything I have. I'm putting all my eggs in this basket. I will not be put to shame in anything. But with all boldness, Christ will even now, as always, be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. He's like, I'm sure of this, whether I die or live, Christ is going to be exalted. This word, a megaluno, means like almost like a magnified. Christ is going to be big. People are going to see little shrimpy Paul, but they're going to see a really big Jesus in Paul. And so he says what could be considered the credo of Paul's life. For me, he says, to live is Christ and to die is gain. To live, to keep on living, that's Christ. And if I was to die, that's only gain. Think about what he's saying here. To live is Christ. He said, if I keep on living, like if I get vindicated, exonerated, you know, I'm gonna keep on exalting Christ. There's a bunch of fruitful service for me to do. And so my life has an incredible, indescribable purpose and meaning and significance and value. That was all part and parcel of Paul's worldview. Yes. He says, but if I die, that's gonna exalt Christ. That's gonna make Christ big. People are gonna see little Paul die, but I'm just like a flea anyways. That's gonna make Jesus look incredible. That a little shrimp like me had the courage to stand up before Nero himself. That's going to exalt Christ too. And he says in verse 23, I'm going to go to heaven, which is better by far. So it's like this. It's like, well, what if I continue to live on a life of incredibly significant eternal service? Well, that would be a pretty good deal. Or what if I die and I go directly seconds later into the presence of God forever? What Jesus called paradise in Luke 23:43. Well, that'd be pretty good too. So to live is Christ, to die is gain. He says in verse 22, if I'm to go on living in this body, it will mean fruitful labor for me. That's if to live is Christ. Yet, what shall I choose? I do not know. I'm hard pressed from both sides. Do you have any idea how weird that is to read from a guy on death row? I got two choices ahead of me, and I don't know which one to pick. It's like, do I go with the Lambo or do I go with the Ferrari? Like, I'm not sure which one. Like, it could be either one. Like, he's really like, I don't know which one to pick. And you're like, come on, let's get out of the candy store. Let's go on to the rest of the mall. I don't know which candy to pick. Like, he's that, like, I don't know which one to pick. And the dilemma, the dichotomy here is, do you want to give the rest of your life in sacrificial service to others and God, or do you want to die? For somebody without a worldview big enough to hold this, this would be crippling. This would be psychologically crippling. Do you want to keep going on like this and giving your life away to others? This is the only life you have, and once you lose it, it's gone forever. Or do you want to die, and then your life is gone forever? But to Paul, he's like a kid in a proverbial candy store. I don't know which one to pick. I'm so excited. So he says, I desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is better by far, that's death, but it is more necessary for you that I remain on in the body. This is service. Desire is epithumia. This is epi meaning over and thumia meaning passion. He's saying I have an over desire to be with Christ. This is usually a word that's used for lust in the New Testament, all but two times. This is one of them. He's like, I'm just so desirous to be with Christ. He'd already been to heaven, 2 Corinthians 12. I can't wait. I can't shut up about this. I've got an over desire to be with Christ. He says, that's better by far. It's interesting, the Greek here, this is a triple comparative meaning. You have those friends who are like, it's like super, super, super cool. Like, this is just so freaking, freaking, freaking awesome. That's what this is. It's like, it's better, 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 better. Why did I say better? Better by far. to go to heaven. Much rather better is a way to take it. By far the better, the best. How could Paul have this sort of mindset? Where he's looking at these two options, either sacrificial service or death. How could he have this mindset? His mindset was this way. Not because he had just some kind of an abstract view of God. Like I just, you know, pray to God when I'm in trouble. And, you know, God's out there and he's like the big guy in the sky. And yeah, he's like up there somewhere. And yeah, I pray sometimes. And that's not the God of the Bible. That certainly wasn't the God whom Paul believed. Paul had this mindset because he had a personal encounter with Jesus Christ. So if you were reading this as a first century document about a guy and you're reading this and you're like, this doesn't make any sense, I'm right there with you, okay? If you're reading this as a secular document by a guy who's just writing from prison, I get it. Like, I wouldn't understand what he's saying either. But I do know what he's saying because in November of 2004, I invited Jesus Christ to come into my life. And that has changed my entire adult life forever. You wouldn't believe the joy, the contentment, the happiness, the purpose. I could stop right there. I remember receiving Christ into my life. I was stoned on drugs at the time. Okay, don't judge me for that. And I was just sitting there in my bed and having Christ come into my life. And I remember sensing, now I have purpose. There's things that I can do that can never be taken away from me. I know many people in this room, you're in the same situation. You know exactly what Paul is talking about here. Why? Because you know Jesus Christ. That's why. If you don't know Jesus Christ, tonight would be a great night to come and meet with him. Because you wouldn't just have some abstract belief system, okay? You would have a personal being coming into your life to be there with you who says, I will never forsake you. I will never abandon you. Well, if there's one thing we could take away here, it's this. It's that this view of our circumstances is not fictitious. Nothing of the sort. It's not imaginative. It's not that we're just looking at our world and we're pretending everything's great. When it's not, Paul was a realist. These guys are selfish. I am in prison. There is a Praetorian guard. I'm stuck in Caesar's. It's all real. That's all real. Here's the deal. When you are stuck in negative, depressed thinking, when you are stuck in a slump, it is not because you're thinking about your situation too much. It's because you're thinking about your situation too little. These kind of reflections from Paul only come from a person who has been sitting in the face of the Lord, thinking through his life, and in a reflective way, having God communicate what is happening behind the scenes and right in front of his face. Our difficulty isn't that God is refusing to move. Our difficulty is that we don't see it. Try and see it.